Good evening. Time to get started this evening. If you want to open your Bibles to Paul's letter to the Colossians, there's a fairly good chance we won't get there this evening. But no, we will. We'll touch a couple of things there, but we want to go through some intro material. As Ken mentioned this morning, the class on Sunday evenings is going to be on Colossians this quarter. And if the Lord permits, we're going to go from Colossians to Philippians next quarter, both short books, but both have a wealth of information in them, enough to spend an entire quarter on. And really two completely different tones, it seems like, in those two books. So there are a couple of good books to look at, one behind the other, probably written at the same time when Paul was in prison, as we'll see this evening there, some of the prison epistles that he wrote. We're going to ask Tommy, if he would, to lead us in prayer as we start. Amen. All right. Before we get into some of the background material we want to look at on Colossians, one of the things that always, for me, is helpful when I'm looking at books, especially of the New Testament, they seem to fit better for this for me. But sometimes if I can get one word in mind associated with a letter or a book, that's helpful, because sometimes they seem to really follow a single or at least a main theme throughout the entire letter, and I think Colossians is that way. When we look at Philippians next quarter, the word that comes to my mind is joy or rejoice, and Paul mentions that numerous times. Or a letter like the Hebrews, the word better is used repeatedly throughout that letter. When you look at Paul's letter to the Ephesians, then it seems to be a very, very strong focus on the church. And where that focus seems to be on the church, then the focus of Colossians seems to be very much on Christ himself. It's been called by some of the commentators the most Christological book in the New Testament. And clearly that seems to be a main focal point of this letter, as we'll see. What do you know about Colossae, the city? As we think about the city of Colossae, what do you know? Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to know a great deal about it. It's mentioned in the scriptures here because the church was there, and Paul wrote a letter to the church. And so we know something about it from that standpoint, but there's not really a lot that we know about it. It was a city of some prominence very early on, but well before the time that Paul wrote this letter. It had fallen into a great decline, really, even by that time. It's about 120 miles east of Ephesus, in the area that we call Asia Minor, the same general area where the seven churches of the book of Revelation were. And so, as a matter of fact, very closely tied to one of those locations. As you think about this triad of cities, when you're looking at a map, and we'll pop up a map in a moment, these three cities, Colossae, Laodicea, which is about 10 miles away, and Hierapolis, which is about 13 miles away, formed kind of a triad of cities there, very close. Colossae had some importance when it was founded initially, and there are some historical records of before the time of Christ, some of those that went through and visited, and some of the prominence that it had. But as Laodicea and Hierapolis started to build up, then Colossae really fell into decline and became a city that had no notoriety really at all, with the exception of some things that Paul wrote about that we'll see in the letter. And then they also produced a particular kind of wool that was tied to that area. Colossinius is what they called it, and it was, if that's how you pronounce that, but it was a special kind of wool. But there wasn't much about the city that we know. When you look at it regarding a map, and I know that probably that's hard to see a lot of those cities, but all the churches of Asia are over here. There's four of them. Sardis is the only one that is labeled here. You've got four running up into that area, Smyrna and Ephesus over here, and then you've got Laodicea, which is down here. This is the Meander River. It actually goes over farther than that. But the Meander River, and then where it forks off here, is where Colossae and Hierapolis are. And because actually, and it's that's not to scale on those dots, obviously, that's much larger. So Colossae, it's in the Lycus River Valley, which is the river that comes off of the Meander. But it's not really directly on the river the same way that some of the other cities were. But it was on a route, the road, as you might call it, that, and that's where it had its prominence initially, the road that would have gone from Ephesus all the way over here to the Euphrates River. So this main east-west thoroughfare, and that's going to become important as far as I think some of the things that Paul even addresses. What would you expect in a church that was on a main road between a city like Ephesus and then all the way considerably to the east of that? What kind of things might you expect? Lots of visitors, no question about that. So people are coming through all the time. Other things that you think of, not only visitors, but what's that? Oh, yeah, absolutely. A lot of different kinds of ideas are coming and channeling back and forth as those visitors come in, or as people set up residence when they come there. The group of people that would be there would be similar to a lot of cities in the United States. You know, there are some places you can go that seem to be very much more local in the people. There are some areas that are much more cosmopolitan than that, and areas that have a lot of different groups of people, different ethnicities and different races and things of that nature in an area. Colossae and Laodicea and Hierapolis and those areas, Ephesus would have certainly been that way as a port city. But there would have been a lot of them in that area with the same kind of mentality. And that's going to make a difference when we start looking at some of the things that Paul wrote to this church in Colossae. And so as you see, this is part of the triad, and as we said, in the Lycus River Valley, at the foot of Mount Cadmus, it's about 1 mile from the current city of Honaz, Turkey, which is kind of interesting because Colossae just kind of fell by the wayside. There ended up being an earthquake we'll talk about in a moment, but even before the earthquake, it had fallen into a great decline. It's a city where Philemon almost assuredly lived. Look at these passages here, Colossians chapter 4. In verse 7, as he's going to be talking about the different people that are associated with this city, it says, Tychicus, a beloved brother, faithful minister, and fellow servant in the Lord, will tell you all the news about me. I'm sending him to you for this very purpose, that he may know your circumstances and comfort your hearts. With Onesimus, and who was Onesimus? He was a slave. And whose slave? He's Philemon's slave. And so it appears that Paul, when he had converted Onesimus, it seems like when Onesimus had escaped, it appears that Paul had had an opportunity to meet up with him, probably had brought about his conversion, at the very least encouraged him or told him he needed to go back in order to be faithful to his relationship. He needed to go back. And so he sends him back to Philemon. Some other passages in down in verse 17 here, he says, and say to Archippus, he says, take heed to the ministry which you have received in the Lord, that you may fulfill it. And so he's going to name different people in here. Some of these may be family with one another. It's hard to tell, but there are occasions where he may be talking about a husband and a wife and a child. And then if you look over at Philemon, in Philemon chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Let me get somebody that's open there. If you get there, just throw a hand up. You there, Tommy? Go ahead and read that for us, first couple of verses there. All right, so there are some that believe that that's giving a family structure, that that's a husband, a wife, and a child, all three being addressed there. But Philemon is there, and apparently the church that is here is meeting in his house. And so a lot of the things that we think in terms of what's going to be written probably exist because of why. Why are these letters so vastly different from one another? Does that make sense? Colossians, Ephesians, Philippians. I'm saying all the letters, some follow a similar structure, but normally the letters were intended to do what? Address whatever specific issues may have existed in that particular congregation. And that's exactly what is going to be going on here in Colossians. So as Paul sends this letter back, he's going to be responding to some of the things that he has heard. Some of the things that he knows about the church there, and going to be addressing those. All three of these cities were decimated by an earthquake or earthquakes. Eusebius says that it was in the 10th year of Nero. Tacitus, who says that obviously neither one of them are historians that were reporting history during their lifetime. These are both after the fact. Tacitus being much closer to the time frame than Eusebius was. But one says that the earthquake hit in the 10th year of Nero. One says that it hit in the 7th year of Nero. And then some of the authors say that's because there were actually a couple of different quakes in the area. I got a couple of pictures here which I thought were interesting, not of Colossae yet, but I wanted to at least give you a picture of this. This is Pamukkale, Turkey. The number one tourist site in Turkey. It's in that same region. And the reason I show that is because it's believed that the fault lines that are running through there that would have been the cause of the earthquakes that would have decimated all three of those cities, Laodicea and Colossae and Hierapolis, which the first two, or I guess the first and the last, were actually rebuilt. Colossae really was never really rebuilt very strongly after the earthquake. But there's great fault lines running through there, and these hot springs and these ledges and these pools. You can look at that picture and probably figure out why it's Turkey's number one tourist location. Similar picture here, just showing you the structures that exist because this whole area sits directly on a fault line. So it wouldn't have been unusual to think in terms of an earthquake decimating the area that was there. And then, as Ken mentioned just a moment ago, never been excavated. That's unusual for a city, at least, that would have enough mention to understand it is a New Testament letter written to the church. There was clearly a church there. There have been a couple of times, as a matter of fact, the last report I read, or the most recent report I read, said that there was an Australian group that was trying to plan an excavation even now, but it hasn't been excavated to date. And so here's kind of what you get when you go to Colossae. You got a nice sign that says you're a Colossae. They're letting you know where it is if you want to go there. But this is what the site looks like. And that's actually the tell that is there where the city was. And it's hard to tell in that picture. Easier to tell in that picture. That's the tell that is right there in the background. This area right here where the city would have been built. This is Mount Cadmus back here. Mount Cadmus is about an 8,000-foot mountain, so it's a decent-sized mountain. And then here's a picture that kind of gives you a shot so that you can see at a different angle. The tell, and they can tell there was a theater there. You can see in the ground that there was a theater, some other things that they've located. It's just that it's never been excavated to really get any additional information about the history of the city that was there. Whether or not many of them lost their lives in the earthquake that decimated it, if the earthquake happened in somewhere between 60 and 64 AD, When was the letter of Colossians written? I mean, approximately, it would have been written when? If it was in Paul's first imprisonment, what's that? In the late 50s, maybe even the early 60s, right in that kind of range. I mean, it may be, as I was looking at this, I thought, I wonder if Tychicus and Onesimus took this letter back sometime very shortly before the earthquake hit and complete destruction of their city. And if so, think about the importance of the things that Paul talks to them about and the things he's trying to get them to understand regarding their relationship to Christ, as we'll get into that, how important that would be when you've got a tragedy that is just around the corner. They don't understand that, but the same idea for us. I mean, you can almost imagine them receiving the letter from Paul and thinking like we would, that tomorrow is going to be tomorrow and things are going to be like they have been. And then you have this massive earthquake hit and decimate the city entirely. So as we think about the church in Colossae, some interesting things about it. It's difficult to know absolutely for sure, but probably Paul was never even there. What would make you think that maybe he wasn't even there? So it's never recorded as Paul's making it, and they went pretty close. No question he went by there pretty closely, but he doesn't mention, there's no mention by Luke of that as being one of the specific cities. And Paul, even within the letter, talks about those that have never seen him face to face, or those who have never, never been with him. And so whether or not that was the majority of the people there because he had never actually been in Colossae or not. So it's a church that Paul's extremely interested in because of information that he gets, but not one that he probably has visited. Epaphras may have founded this church, may have founded the church in Laodicea and Hierapolis. Interesting things that are said. If you look again back at chapter 1 and verse 7, he says, "As you also learned from Epaphras, our dear fellow servant, who is a faithful minister of Christ on your behalf, who also declared to us your love in the Spirit." So what are you thinking that Epaphras' relationship would have been? Jump over to chapter 4, verse 12. He says, "Epaphras, who is one of you, a bondservant of Christ, greets you always, laboring fervently for you in prayers, that you may stand perfect and complete in all the will of God. For I bear him witness that he has a great zeal for you and those who are in Laodicea and those who are in Hierapolis." So he certainly had some kind of tie to all three of those groups. It may be that when Paul was in Ephesus, and that's about 100 miles, 120 miles away, when Paul was in Ephesus, that may be when Epaphras was doing work back in this area, in Colossae. Somebody turn to Acts 19:10. That's a great passage. Paul's in Ephesus, but it's a great statement about what is going on. Is there David, you there?
"This continued for 2 years, so that all the residents of Asia heard the word of the Lord."
All right, so Paul's in Ephesus, so you would expect that in 2 years' time, all of those in Ephesus would have certainly had a great exposure to the word. But the statement is made that it wasn't just in Ephesus, that all of those in Asia, the word is going out. So Paul's there in Ephesus, but there are people that are going out and taking the word to these other places. Epaphras seems to be one of those. He's the one that brings the information from the congregation to Paul so that Paul understands what's going on there. He's one of them, and he's one of the ones that Paul says, you need to know how this brother is praying for you and how fervently involved he is with you. So that's very likely when this church would have been founded, at least. So that would have been sometime earlier in the 50s when Paul was on that journey. That would have been his third journey when Paul's in Ephesus for a couple of years. And you've got the relationship being built with the whole area. Probably delivered, maybe not just this letter, but all of the prison epistles may have been delivered by Tychicus and Onesimus. They may have been the ones that were sent as the messenger. They certainly were taking a message back to Philemon. They certainly being addressed in Colossians as taking the lesson or the message to Colossians, the Colossians as well, and the Ephesians. So these were kind of the bearers of the word. Paul probably wrote these letters very closely together, may have sent all these letters out to these groups at the same time. And then this is what we were talking about. Due to the location, considerable variance of people and ideas. And so it depends on who you were writing to as to what the biggest problems that they were going to be facing were. But if you've got a group of Christians meeting that has Jews and Greeks and has people coming in from the East, and you've got all these people coming into this one area, the amount of ideas that are coming in are pretty incredible. And so a lot of the commentators refer to the Colossian heresy, and saying that Paul was dealing with the Colossian heresy. That wasn't just a specific one doctrine. But here's what you're going to see that Paul does in the letter. He writes and says that there are some people that are wanting you to add Judaism to your Christianity. There are some people that are wanting you to add philosophy to your Christianity. So you've got one idea coming from the Jews, one idea coming from the wisdom, so-called wisdom of the East, and somebody saying they're trying to get you to add this to your Christianity. Others were saying you need to add this concept of asceticism, which is what? Self-denial. And so even to the point of afflicting oneself with pain or other things in order to gain self-control. And so they're saying, You need to add all of this to your Christianity, or different groups were saying, add this to your Christianity, this to your Christianity. So you're going to find out that Colossians is a letter where Paul really seems to be getting across one message. He's trying to get across the all-sufficiency of Christ. What do you think the difficulty with the message of Christ is completely sufficient for what you need? What's the difficulty of getting people to understand that message? Yeah, Deb? Yeah, no question. She says that, you know, they're so used to a polytheistic approach to things, and they've got their many gods and gods for everything. All of a sudden, they're being preached a one God. The whole concept is foreign. How do we think in terms of just a single God? Other things you think would present difficulty with that? Yeah, radically different. And like Ken says, you're going to have to give up this whole philosophy that is being taught, and not as a philosophy. Obviously, it's the gospel. But I'm saying, as this message is coming into them, it is a complete killing of self. In order to give oneself up to Jesus Christ. That's going to be extremely difficult no matter where. People wrestle with the idea today, do they not? The simplicity even of Christ? I always think of, when I think of what Paul wrote here, for me, I always have in the back of my mind, I think of the whole discussion with Naaman and his leprosy. The whole problem with Naaman and his leprosy was what? This is too easy. This can't be right. Dip in the Jordan. Look at this muddy old river. The rivers back home are so much better. If you're going to have to dip in a river, surely it should be a great river. And the argument that his servant made to him was what? Yeah, if he had asked you some great thing, if he had asked you to just absolutely go overboard on what it took in order to get rid of this problem that you've got with the leprosy, you would have jumped at the chance. But he comes out with a simple solution. Christianity does that with people. And so they think, well, let me add this to it. There's got to be more to it than just the simplicity of giving one's life over to Jesus Christ. And so philosophies come in. People do that today, do they not? When you think of what people are doing with Christianity, how frequent is it that people are adding things to it? You've got to put these other ideas, these other philosophies with it. Or, like the Jews, where somebody is trying to make something very legal and binding on them, he's going to deal with all of that as well. He's going to say, you know what? People are trying to tell you things about food. They're trying to tell you things about other issues. And I'm telling you, you're missing the point. He said it is the all-sufficiency of Jesus Christ. In Colossians chapter 2, that's kind of a theme verse, or one of the key verses for sure for the entire letter. For in him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. He's saying that you've got to understand, every single thing that you need, Paul says, is in Jesus Christ. So you're going to see when we get into the outline of this book that Paul's going to be taking that one point, it seems like, and doing different things with it, but building on that throughout this entire letter. And so as we think about the outline of what Paul is going to do, because it seems to break itself down into two sections, really, chapters 1 and 2, and then chapters 3 and 4. And he's going to be dealing with different things. When you get to chapter 3, he's going to make a conclusion-type statement when he says, if then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above. And you'll see how that ties in when we look at the outline that we'll be going through. And I've got a copy of this. We'll have the guys pass that out in a minute. Tommy and Nathan have copies of this on a card that's going to give you an outline of each week what scriptures in the book we're going to be covering. So it would certainly be advantageous if you would read those ahead of time. And that's not obviously going to be a great deal of reading. I'm covering 4 chapters in 13 weeks. Ken's covering this gigantic chunk of the Old Testament in 13 weeks. So the readings for this class will be easy. You've got 13 weeks to read 4 chapters worth. I'd encourage you to read the whole letter a couple times first, but in its entirety, and then go back and start looking at the sections. But he's going to talk about the preeminence of Jesus Christ. What does the preeminence mean? What does that word mean? Of first importance. So what's the difference in Christ being preeminent versus Christ being prominent? Yeah, I mean, prominent just carries the idea of more important than some other things, not necessarily more important than every other thing, but preeminent. He's all the way at the front. And what Paul's going to do in this message is say, he's going to declare that first, that you have to understand that this is, in fact, the truth. And it shows up in different areas. This is the letter where Paul's going to say, let's talk about the fact of what he has done. He's preeminent because he's the creator. That automatically puts you in a position of preeminence. He's associated with God the Father in creation, and we know that when we go back, because all the verbiage says what in the Old Testament? When they're talking about creating man, the very statement is what? Let us create man in our image. We know that they're heavily involved in the creation together. I don't know if you've ever studied with somebody that believes, there's some groups that believe that Jesus is prominent, not preeminent. That Jesus holds a place of great importance, but he's not truly God or the Son of God. And when you turn to certain passages, like in Colossians, and it talks about the creation, it's interesting, they've got Bible versions that will just slightly alter some of those statements so that Jesus becomes the creator of all other things rather than the creator of all things. But he's going to say, just by the fact of who Jesus is in redemption, in creation, that makes him preeminent. It puts him in that position automatically. Very similar to just the concept of God. If you accept the concept of God, God the Father, God the Creator, then God automatically has authority over us. Would he not? If he's God and we're not, then just by that's inherent with being God. Same thing with Jesus. He's going to talk about in Paul's ministry and in the church that Jesus holds that position. And so he's going to declare first, saying, you need to understand, the teaching is that Jesus Christ is preeminent above all things. Secondly, he's going to defend that. He's going to say, so let's talk about what some other people are telling you. Let's talk about those people who are telling you that you've got to add these different concepts or different beliefs. How do people supplement Jesus Christ today? What's that? Oh, yeah, with the worship of saints. You know, in addition to worshiping Christ, then they will worship those who have been declared as saints and sainthood been pronounced on them. Joe? Yeah, no question. As man writes his own understandings of things and defines and therefore writes creeds to put along with the word of God. I remember watching a lesson or listening to a preacher, and it's been a long time ago. He had a whole stack of creed books. And I just thought it was interesting the way he approached it. I'd never seen anybody do that before. He said, and he took his Bible, and he said, if this will make you a Christian, would you agree that you can be made a Christian from what's in here? He said, so if this will make you a Christian, and you take a man-written book and put it on top, what will the two of them together make you? I mean, it has to make you something different if the book serves any purpose at all. Has to make you something different than a Christian. If all it does is say what the Bible says, then obviously it would be unnecessary. And I just thought it was an interesting concept. He said that as man writes books, as man gives his philosophies, his ideas, then you've added something to. Other ways that people might supplement. Can you think of any other ways? Yeah, Deb. Yeah, no question. The whole idea of the worship of angels, or to us it seems completely foreign to think in terms of worshiping the God of the sun or worshiping the God of the moon, and yet we have a society that gets highly involved in the position of the planets and what it says about you. And you need to understand that as well. I met with a woman in Kansas City before we left, and she was becoming very big in the idea of Earth and how you needed to add the concept of the Mother Earth and the worship of Earth and crystals and the things that are associated with that. A lot of different philosophies. And Paul's saying Jesus Christ is sufficient. What about legalism? How do they supplement with the legalism of the Jews? I mean, there are certain ways that were very easy to understand. What are some of the ways they would have supplemented the message of Christ? Circumcision, probably the biggest one, no question, wasn't it? That circumcision was an issue. And, you know, it was good to be a Christian. You just needed to be circumcised first. You needed to become a Jew before you became a Christian. Circumcision became binding. And we know that circumcision was not disallowed. It wasn't that God was saying you can no longer be circumcised because the Jewish law has fallen by the wayside. How do you know that it wasn't disallowed? Yeah, Timothy was circumcised. Paul had him circumcised. He said that's not the issue. The issue is when I try to tell you it has to be added to the doctrine of Jesus Christ. That's when it becomes an issue. Joe? Yeah. Yeah, no question. And so they would have bound those days on you, those times on you. And again, Paul deals with that in the book of Romans, doesn't he? He says, you know what? One may celebrate a day, one may not. You can't bind it. It's not a part of the law. But he says, I understand, and especially as you're coming out of Judaism, it would have been probably illogical to think that you could have been a Jew all your life and then become a Christian, and then on the first Saturday that you get up as a Christian, that you have no conscience tied to the Sabbath at all, and that you can just get up and do whatever you want. Now, God says you did have the freedom to do that, but they would have kept a lot of those traditions. But he says, if you can hold on to those yourself. They could have done things themselves, but you can't bind that on somebody else. And then he talks about the man-made disciplines. You know what? You'll become a better Christian if you would take a vow of silence, if you would decide that you're going to do this to your body, if you would restrict yourself from this food, whatever the case may be. He's going to say people add a lot of different things in. And the letter of Colossians is going to say, declare the preeminence of Christ and then defend it, telling you these things are not right. Because then when he gets into that last section, he's going to say it's demonstrated. And that's what becomes most important, I think, when we get into this letter. Paul's going to say things that you know Christ is preeminent in your life based on your own personal purity, your moral decisions. Is he really preeminent or not? And he's going to talk about that. That's when chapter 3, and he says, if you've been raised with Christ, he says, where should your mind be focused? On those things that are above. He said that the way you think will help you understand. I think he gives us some tests that are objective. I can look at myself and tell whether or not he truly is preeminent in my life. You know, when we teach our marriage classes, one of the things we talk about is husbands and how critically important it seems to be based on 1 Peter chapter 3. To hold their wives up in a position of honor, an idea of showing the wife that outside of God or Christ themselves, that my wife is the most important aspect of my life. That is first and foremost outside of my relationship with God. But I could claim that, and I could do a lot of things that would show her she's not. Would you agree with that? And that's what Paul's going to be doing. Paul's going to say, you can claim Christ is preeminent, but let's talk about the way you live. He's going to talk about in your relationship to other brethren, the whole concept of fellowship and the way we share with one another and what that means. In the home, how do you treat your wife? He says, Christ is preeminent if you're the kind of husband that you're supposed to be, you're the kind of wife you're supposed to be, if you're the kind of parents or the kind of children that you're supposed to be. He's saying you can look at your home life and tell whether or not Jesus Christ is preeminent in your life. In your work relationships, is God truly the most important thing to you? I used to have a cartoon up in my office. I can't even remember who gave it to me. It was some guys standing around the water cooler talking. And they were just talking about their faith. And the one guy said, I believe in God. He says, but nobody I work with knows that. I just thought that's kind of an interesting concept. God is important to me, but I've been able to keep that well hidden at work. He's going to say, the method you work, your whole mentality. Where I used to work in Tampa, worked for a mechanical company there, doing design work, that kind of thing. And so my office was kind of down the hallway. The guy that was our comptroller there, his office was just off of the main area, and you could see out the glass doors to the street that pulled into the employee parking lot. And so he took it upon himself to announce every time the boss would pull his car back into the parking lot. So, make an announcement through the office that the boss had pulled into the parking lot, which was just another way of saying, you probably ought to go ahead and start working now. Because people were not working prior to that time. Paul says, really? How you work, what your work ethic is going to tell you whether Christ is driving your life or not. How we how we witness or talk to other people about Jesus Christ, all of those things, our whole service toward one another and toward others. He's going to help us in chapters 3 and 4 to say there are some objective things that you can look at that will let you know whether or not Jesus Christ is preeminent in your life. And so it seems to be him helping them, whatever this conglomeration that created this, what's referred to as the Colossian heresy, whether it was just a single thing or whether it was all these multiple things. But Paul's dealing with all those to say, you're going to have to make a decision. I love the book for this reason, because he helps me understand. And my wife has said things to me on occasion that help you understand. You're not treating me like the most important thing in your life. You know, maybe you say something, maybe you get a little selfish. I know I'm probably the only husband that's ever gotten selfish, but, you know, when that happens, you need that information, that you're not demonstrating that. And that's what Paul's going to do. Paul's going to say, let me give you some helpful information to let you know, is Jesus truly preeminent in your life? And that seems to be what this letter is written about, because you got this whole mix of ideas that was coming in, and Paul's just saying, Christ is everything you need if you just make application of him in your life. All right? Does that make sense? I just want to kind of give us an outline. I'm going to ask Nathan and Tommy, if they would, to pass those out. Any questions or comments? We want to get into chapter 1 next time, and if you'll look at this outline, it's going to give you your readings each time. We just kind of had the intro tonight, but we want to get into these readings and then talk about all of that. You guys will probably have to stand up to pass those out. Oh, we're okay. I assure you, I owe him multiple opportunities of trolling. Well, thank you for your attention.